Okay. Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Okay. Thank you for coming this morning. First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers, the entire organizing committee, for this wonderful opportunity and for the invitation. I'd like to thank you all for coming this morning. So what I'm going to talk about today is pulsar wind nebulae from a high energy observational perspective with grad students in mind. So some of this stuff is very familiar to active researchers in pulsar wind nebula community, but my goal here is to highlight these for non-pulsar wind nebula people as well. And I'm going to focus on the growing diversity of these objects with respect to the entire SNR population, and also in connection to their inside, which is the powering engines, pulsars, as well as the outside, which is the environment and their supernova progenitors. So we're in Greece. There is a very strong connection to Greece for pulsar wind nebulae, as most of you know. These are also referred to as plerions, which comes from the Greek word pleris, which pretty much is the only word I know in Greek. That's called as such because they have a centrally filled morphology, as we know from the Crab Nebula. This is a term which was coined back in 1978 by now late Wheeler and Panagia. There is another connection to Greece. Apparently, pulsar wind nebula refers to Patras wireless network from Wikipedia, which is a wireless community network operating in Patras, Greece. So in terms of the connection to the entire SNR population, we currently know of about 380 supernova remnants in our own galaxy. And this number is taken from the high energy catalog of supernova remnants, which is developed at the University of Manitoba, thanks to Gilles Ferrand, who's sitting in the back. It's slightly higher than what Dave Green uses in the radio catalog because we are including the strong candidates, but also a complete list of pulsar wind nebula, including the shell-less crab-like pulsar wind nebula and Boshak nebula. So there's about 50 extra candidates from there, right there. Given the number of participants at this conference, there's about 2 to 3 SNRs for everyone in this room to work on. But also, pulsar wind nebula represent a significant fraction. About 30% of the SNR population contains pulsar wind nebula or pulsar wind nebula candidates. Most of them are detected now by Chandra. And roughly half of them lack shells. We know that these result from core collapse explosions, so we do expect to see a shell surrounding them. However, one of the biggest mysteries about these objects, including the Crab Nebula, is that we do not see shells in roughly 50% of these objects. 64% are powered by detected pulsars, and this number keeps growing with timing searches for pulsations in these objects. And as you know, TEV gamma ray astronomy have opened a whole new window into studying these objects, particularly the older population, which we call the relic pulsar wind nebulae. And out of the 78 galactic TEV known sources, 38 have been identified as pulsar wind nebula or pulsar wind nebula candidates. So they represent the largest population of TEV sources. And Fermi as well has looked at all of these TEV sources and have identified 11 candidates as well as 5 confirmed nebulae. And here I refer you to the talks that we heard yesterday by Ryan on the Hess Galactic Plane Survey as well as Hélène Condin on the Fermilab results. So why bother studying these objects? I'll have a lot of slides on that. And as I'm showing you why it's important to study these objects, I'll go over some of the physics we learn primarily from high energy observations. So as you all know, these are bubbles of relativistic particles injected by commonly believed rotation-powered pulsar where the wind, as it encounters the surrounding medium, gets shot at a radius, which is determined by equating the thrust from the pulsar with the confining pressure and given by this formula. So for typical properties of E dot and confining pressure, it turns out that the termination shock is at a very small radius, about 0.1 parsecs, for example, for the crab. So you need sub-arcsecond resolution to image these objects. And that's why they're perfect objects for study with Chandra, and they have become a legacy for the Chandra X-ray satellite. And also only now we are also able to study them with NuSTAR, the first hard X-ray imaging satellite that's allowing us to also study these objects in the hard X-ray band. So most of you have seen this. This is a gallery of some of the pulsar wind nebula detected with the Chandra X-ray telescope, highlighting very high resolution structures seen in the majority, in particular Taurus-like structures and jet-like structures, which have been reproduced successfully with numerical simulations. And here I point you to a talk by Omi on the theoretical studies of these objects and simulations. Now, one of the important things we've been doing with Chandra XMM and recently with NuSTAR is performing spectral index maps. And this is very important because it allows us to probe the physics of the pulsar wind and the models for diffusion into the nebula. So what you're seeing here is the spectral index maps of the Crab Nebula with Chandra and XMM in the 0.5 to 10 keV band and with the NuSTAR in the hard X-ray band. This is the spectral index map for the Vela with the index here ranging from 1 to 2.5, the photon index. This is 3C58 with the photon index as a function of radius. So we know that the radiation is synchrotron emission from relativistic particles, and we know that for frequencies for which the synchrotron lifetime is smaller than the flow time to the edge of the nebula, one expects to see some steepening of the index as you go away from the pulsar. And this has been observed in a number of pulsar wind nebula as shown here. So you see the index steepens as you go away from the pulsar. This is the theoretical prediction based on the canonical model of Kennel and Coronetti, which involves an idealized MHD outflow with toroidal magnetic field. So you see that it doesn't follow that, suggesting that there is deviations from a toroidal field, and also suggesting that particles can diffuse outward to much larger radii than predicted by this model, implying that diffusion can play a very important role. Another thing to point out is that by doing spatially resolved spectroscopy and making images at different energy bands, we see that the size of the nebula shrinks with increasing energy. However, the rate of shrinkage depends on where you're looking in the nebula. For example, in the case of the Crab Nebula, the rate of shrinkage along the torus is as expected in the Kennel and Coronelli model. But if you look at the jet and counterjet, this rate of shrinkage is also much faster. Again, that indicates that there is another process in play, for example, in-situ particle acceleration or particle diffusion possibly along a radial magnetic field. There is this other type of pulsar wind nebula, which we call bow-shock nebula. In this case, the pulsars are moving supersonically. Their velocity is greater than the local sound speed in the SNR or in the ISM. So you end up having this bow-shock structure, which is, again, determined by equating the thrust of the pulsar with the ram pressure in the interstellar medium, where this is the ambient density and this is the pulsar velocity. And these are characterized by a bow-shock with a head and long trail behind them. There's a growing evidence of these very interesting jet-like structures coming out of some pulsars, including this one shown here, which is known as the Lighthouse Nebula. It's believed that the pulsar are going in this direction, but this is very long jet, perhaps the longest jet associated with a pulsar wind nebula, and I refer you to the talk later today on this and other trails from pulsars. So moving on, these for pulsar hunters, these are great objects to locate pulsars. They are calorimeters for studying and finding pulsars. This here shows the X-ray luminosity of a sample of pulsars detected with a known rotational energy loss. And even though there's a large scatter of this X-ray luminosity ranging from 10 to the minus 5 LX over E dot to 10 to the minus 1, there is a very strong correlation of LX as a function of E dot. And this is expected because these are powered by rotational energy loss. So normally higher E dot implies higher X-ray luminosity, again with a large scatter. Now, nebula, these are examples of some interesting nebula that led to the discovery of very interesting pulsars, pulsars that have been searched for decades, and it's only with Chandra imager that we were able to actually find these pulsars. This is a radio, large radio nebula that have long, for decades, known to be a pulsar with nebula candidate. By pointing Chandra to the center, we found evidence of very compact point source surrounded by a compact nebula, which turned out to be one of the most energetic but far away pulsars in our galaxy. This is another example which, thanks to Chandra imaging, led to the discovery of a pulsar with nebula, which is just shown by the color, the harder X-ray emission shown here, and by performing timing measurements led to the discovery of a pulsar. And these are famous youngish pulsar with nebula 3C58, G54.1, and G21.5. All now having pulsars whose properties have been indirectly initially inferred from studying the pulsar with nebula, their calorimeters, but eventually now we know all their timing properties. Moving on to these objects injecting energetic particles and magnetic fields in the interstellar medium. Therefore, they're very efficient engines for cosmic ray acceleration up to TeV energies. And this shows here the population of TeV sources illustrating pulsar with nebula being a very large class among these objects and possibly also contributing to these unidentified TeV sources. Now, we know that pulsar with nebula emit radiation across the electromagnetic spectrum. The radio, the emission from radio all the way to MeV is synchrotron radiation. And from MeV to TeV, it's believed to be inverse Compton scattering from the synchrotron spectrum of the cosmic microwave background or optical or infrared photons. And so this is the inverse Compton scattering, which we call the leptonic emission. But there are also models that called hadronic, where you have emission from pi zero decay, which results from proton-proton interaction, which might indicate the presence of relativistic protons. And that's important for people who study cosmic ray acceleration and the origin of galactic TeV cosmic rays. And so this is a picture that shows the spectral indices for these objects in the X-rays and gamma rays. So the pulsar with nebula and the radio have very flat index, but as you go to higher energy, it gets steeper. These are the X-ray detected pulsar with nebula with an index between 1.5 and 2, and it gets steeper as you go to higher energies. Now, TeV observations have allowed us to particularly probe the older ones, and this is a cartoon that that illustrates the model for evolution of pulsar with nebula, and I'll say this very briefly because the evolution will be covered in a later talk today by Thea Temem. So basically, you have a pulsar with nebula expanding in the surrounding supernova remnant, and as the remnant enters the Seda phase, you have a reverse shock that eventually shocks the pulsar with nebula and compresses it, and eventually the pulsar will leave actually this bubble, leaving behind what we call a relic pulsar with nebula, which is seen in radio, and it's offset from the peak of X-ray emission, whereby you have a very compact nebula, mostly seen in X-rays, as it gives you the traces the relativistic particles freshly injected by the pulsar. And these are observations that illustrate these stages. These are young pulsar with nebula and young supernova remnants, which are believed to be in the early stages. And here is an example of an offset pulsar with nebula where the X-ray emission is way offset from the TeV gamma ray emission. Population studies in gamma rays with the HESS have been done, and this is preliminary studies from last year's Cosmic Ray Conference, which shows the, by Klepter et al., which shows the gamma ray luminosity as a function of the spin-down power, showing that the gamma ray luminosity tends to fade with time, although the trend is not as strong as seen in the X-ray band. And also the extension of the pulsar with nebula as a function of age, there is a trend for the nebula to get bigger as they get older, as I showed in the previous slide. There's a warning here is that, as you know, the characteristic age can be way off from the actual age of the system. So these ages sometimes have to be taken with a grain of salt because they're not accurate measurements of the ages of the system. Now, moving to the diversity of these objects, and first of all, connection to their powering engines, I'm going to highlight the growing evidence now of pulsar wind nebula surrounding different types of objects. So far, I've been talking about rotation-powered pulsars, and I briefly mentioned supersonic Boshak nebula, but there's growing evidence that pulsar wind nebula can be also driven by magnetars or highly magnetized neutron stars. For pulsar wind nebula around binaries, please see the poster by Mallory Roberts. So this shows the growing diversity of neutron stars, which is given by this PP dot diagram, which is commonly used by pulsar astronomers, where you see the bulk of pulsars are in this region. These are lines of constant magnetic field, and these are lines of constant age, which are given by these two formula. This is an important line, which is called the QED, quantum electrodynamic, 4.4 times 10 to the 13, which separates the rotation power pulsars from the high B pulsars and magnetars. In green here, you see the X-ray nebula surrounding these high B pulsars, and the dashed circles are pulsar wind nebula, which are questionable, but they have been proposed to be surrounding magnetars. One of the challenges in studying nebula around magnetars is that these are very heavily absorbed objects, and they're also very bright, and as a result, you expect to see them surrounded by dust-scattering halos. So if there's any, and they have a low spin-down energy, so if there's any synchrotron nebula underneath, it's going to be very hard and challenging to detect it. So this is a slide that shows some pulsar wind nebula around two high B pulsars and two another high B pulsar called RAT and a magnetar. For these two objects, J1119 in supernova G292-0.5 and J1846 in supernova KES75, they're both surrounded by pulsar wind nebula. And even though they have very similar spin properties, these objects are very different. In the case of J1119, it has a very compact nebula with an extended jet-like structure, but the X-ray luminosity is a very small fraction of the spin-down energy, which is comparable to what we see around rotation power pulsars. In the case of J1846, this is a very important target because it linked rotation power pulsars to magnetars. It's been always thought to be a crab-like pulsar, but it showed evidence of a magnetar-like behavior through an outburst activity and spectral changes with RXT and Chandra, respectively, that led to the conclusion that this object is sometimes behaving like a magnetar. The nebula around it is very bright, and in fact, the X-ray luminosity is a very high fraction of EDOT, suggesting there's something unusual about this object. Now, for this one, the Swift SOAR, which is a magnetar, these are two observations that suggested the presence of an extended emission. And to further probe that emission or confirm or refute the pulsar wind nebula nature of this object, deep observations were performed with XMM. This is a color band RGB image where the colors refer to different energies in the X-ray band, but you clearly see an extended emission whose photon index is consistent with that observed with in other pulsar wind nebula. So so the authors concluded that this is firm evidence for a pulsar wind nebula around a magnetar, except the LX over E dot is very, very high in comparison to the rotation power pulsars. So this is a table which summarizes the X-ray nebula around highly magnetized pulsars, the two HBPs and high B pulsars and another RAD source, and there's these magnetar sources. This one is taken out because now it's believed to be a dust-scattering halo, and this is a new object where new observations suggest the presence of a pulsar wind nebula that's yet to be confirmed. So the conclusion is whether nebula, if detected around highly magnetized pulsars, are powered by rotation and or magnetism is still an open question. How much time do I have, Pat? Seven minutes. So I'm going to skip this part of my talk, which is on the intermediate stage where you have a pulsar wind nebula, which is possibly shocked by a reverse shock. This will be covered in detail by Thea. But if I get 10-minute question period, please ask me questions about it so I can use those slides then. But I'd like to move to a very important topic, which is the connection also of this diversity to the outside, to the environment, but also to the supernova progenitors, which created those nebula in the first place. So as you know, and as I mentioned, and as you heard yesterday from Roger, there's the crab by itself is still a puzzle in terms of the absence of a shell. These are two totally different pulsar wind nebula, but they both lack the shell. The left image is, again, that radio nebula, which led to the discovery of the pulsar right at the center, a very highly energetic pulsar, but very compact X-ray nebula, which is about 20 times smaller in size than the radio nebula. And this is the crab. Both of them lack shells. There are, on the other extreme, there are these pleurionic composites, where you have pulsar wind nebula sitting inside very bright thermal X-ray emission, as illustrated in this object, MSH 50-52 and G292. This is a beautiful deep image of this oxygen-rich supernova remnant. This could be an older version of Cassiopeia A, SNR, with the pulsar wind nebula right there. But this is really rich in thermal X-ray emission that can allow us to study the progenitor of this object. There are these two, 3C58 and G54.1, which have been classified as naked pulsar wind nebula. They don't have a shell, but now we have growing evidence of some thermal X-ray emission, which could be attributed to the supernova remnant or circumstellar interaction, but it's very weak in comparison to those pleurionic composites. And there is this very bizarre object, G21.5, which is believed to be a very young object, has been used as a calibration target for the Chandra X-ray telescope. We were very excited when the accumulating all these observations led to the discovery of this SNR shell, which could be the blast wave of the explosion. But the surprise there is that this emission is primarily non-thermal. So it's very hard to probe the thermal emission from this object if it exists. So all of these objects are interestingly powered by rotation power pulsars with very similar pulsar properties, but obviously the presence or absence of a shell is questionable in these objects. So going back to Wheeler, who coined the term a pleurion, and that problem existed even back in the late 70s. And his I'm quoting him here from his review paper in 1988. He says the reason for presence in in pleurionic shell or composite SNRs, or the lack in the pure pleurions, so these are the pleurionic composites and these are the pleurions, the presence or absence of a shell has not been resolved, and it's still the case today. Wheeler, 1985A, suggests that it's due to a more tenuous ISM surrounding the pure pleurions, leading to lack of formation or formation of an undetectably faint shell. So that's one of the commonly believed scenarios. But also we know that it's possible that they are very low energy supernovae that didn't end up forming the shell to start with. And we heard about the crab from Roger yesterday, but this goes back to 1982 by Nomoto et al., who basically determined the mass of the progenitor of this object to be about 10 solar masses. Roger Chevalier predicted that this is a type 2P supernova, that is a supernova in the mass range of 8 to 25 solar masses with a red supergiant progenitor and that has kept its hydrogen envelope. And 2 years ago, there was this paper by Nathan Smith, which suggested that it's indeed a low-energy explosion, as has been proposed by other authors, but it must be a specific type, type 2N, with narrow hydrogen lines. And the reason for this suggestion is because this object has an unusually low kinetic energy, about 10 to the 50 ergs, at least an order of magnitude less than that from a normal supernova. However, it was very bright in comparison to type 2P, with a peak absolute magnitude of minus 18. So to resolve this puzzle, they suggested there must have been a very intense circumstellar interaction, or type 2NP, which then leads to a cold, dense shell, which eventually fragments and form the Rayleigh-Taylor filaments that are seen in the Crab Nebula. But we also heard from Roger yesterday that this is no longer a problem, and they can still be explained by a low-energy explosion of type 2P. These other two pulsar wind nebula, 3C58 and G54.3, they also, like I said, there is evidence of thermal X-ray emission that came about with XMM. And if you look at the spectral index, it steepens as you go away from the pulsar. But there's also evidence as you go away with thermal plasma, who a very low temperature and enhanced neon abundance, suggesting some circumstellar interaction or the presence of ejecta. So again, it's type 2, suggested that it's a type 2, and there is recent work by Gelfand et al., which takes into account the dynamical evolution of the pulsar wind nebula, as well as the radiative evolution, and they predict a mass of 15 to 20 solar masses, which is also consistent with a type 2P supernova. G21.5 minus 0.1 minus 0.9. Again, this is also suggested to be a type 2P. So there's a pattern there for these shell-less type nebulae. And like I mentioned, despite all the data that we got, I have a poster by new grad student Ben Guest at the University of Manitoba, who's continuing to use all the calibration data, thanks to Chandra. So now we have more than 1 megasecond of time on this object, and still the shell is dominated by non-thermal X-ray emission, which is disappointing in some way, but also exciting because it might be a good target. It's evidence of acceleration to TV energies in a pulsar wind nebula. So to conclude, pulsar wind nebula, we've learned a lot about these objects. A lot of questions remain to be answered. The hope is that Chandra and XMM and New Star will live much longer, because there is, even though Chandra detected most pulsar wind nebula among the SNR population, we still have very poor statistics in many of these pulsar wind nebula. So very deep observations are now needed for many of these objects. But the point I made earlier is that thermal X-ray emission is very important to address the progenitors of these objects, not just for pulsar wind nebula, but for SNRs in general. We were looking forward to AstroH and the microcalorimeter to perform this type of study. So there's a sad face, because you heard about this yesterday from Brian, but there's a happy face, because the power of X-ray spectroscopy has been demonstrated in space thanks to Hitomi, and first light data taken, for example, for Perseus cluster that was shown yesterday by Brian Williams. So we had simulations of pulsar wind nebulae, and I refer you to the white paper on that. This is a simulation for 3C58 based on the XMM thermal X-ray emission, which shows that we should be able to distinguish between an ISM interaction versus an ejecta of 18 solar masses in this case. Another thing we could do with high-resolution spectroscopy is study line broadening. For this young object, one expects to see very high ion temperature, and line broadening should be doable with microcalorimeter type spectra. Another thing to do is to unveil the nature of these unidentified gamma ray sources and to complete the census, which requires further studies with high throughput, sub-arc second resolution, or arc second type resolution, for example, with Athena, as well as the proposed, currently being discussed by the US community X-ray surveyor, which is kind of like Chandra type resolution, but much, much more sensitive. And all this should benefit from the synergy with the Cherenkov telescope array in the gamma rays, and in radio with the square kilometer array. So in conclusion, this is SNR CAT showing you in color the detected sources with X-ray and gamma ray emission. You see Chandra is the most populated, but there are lots of black boxes still to fill with more observations with current generation instruments. But beyond 2018, unfortunately, the only certain future mission is Athena. Hopefully, we don't have to wait that long, but this is certainly a very exciting mission for these types of studies. I'll skip the magnetic field. You can ask me about that. And I'd like to stop and acknowledge contributions from collaborators, particularly Roland, shown here, and also all the Pulsar Wind Nebula researchers without whom this talk would not be possible. Thanks again for the organizers and all of you. Thank you.
Thanks, Samar.
Do I have 10 minutes for questions?
A little bit less, but a fair amount. Kira?
Thank you very much for your nice review. And I have one comment and one question. As for the comment, I like the idea of the weak explosion for Crab Nebula because there are a lot of core collapse supernova simulation, engine simulation, which shows a weak explosion. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are many difficulties in the simulation of core collapse supernova, but currently there are many simulations show weak explosion. So this is one thing. And as for the question, you mentioned about that the TEV, GEV gamma rays, which result from hadronic process. I think you showed a slide about that. So my naive question is that from where hadron is coming from the Pulsar Wind Nebula? From the surface of the neutron star?
So, I mean, this is a very good question. I think if there are relativistic protons in the pulsar winds, this would be the source for interaction with some dense matter in the ambient. So as the wind, presumably having relativistic protons, encounter the thermal gas, and hopefully if there's a dense medium around it, the proton-proton interaction would lead to pi zero decay and therefore this hadronic process. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay. Dan?
Lovely talk. A few years ago, there was a some kind of, I remember a paper about the Pulsar Wind Nebula candidate in the Cygnus loop. Maybe I missed it, but could you comment on that? It's just of interest because if true, then it implies some very high kick velocity of 1,800 kilometers per second.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about the one in the southern region of the
That's
Cygnus
right.
loop
Correct.
By Katsuda at all?
Correct.
Okay,
Correct.
So I didn't talk about that. So, you know, the Cygnus loop is a huge, huge remnant. There's a poster outside, by the way, on the Cygnus loop. So please look at it. But we don't talk about the Pulsar Wind Nebula there. But I personally got very excited about this because actually in the poster we revived the idea that it's two supernova remnants, which has been proposed a long time ago by radio astronomers from Canada who suspected this is two SNR scenario. And I realize the majority of the community do not consider this anymore. But we have new data in the radio with Galfax survey that actually enhances this idea that you have a southern remnant, very small in comparison to the majority of the northern part. And the idea of having a pulsar wind nebula there makes it even more exciting because then it makes it a good candidate for this. But I talked to Satoru Katsuda about this because we were considering more, proposing for more time for this. And he thinks this idea is no longer valid because new XMM data do not reveal this. It might be unrelated objects.
Okay, very interesting. And I'll plan a question. Why don't you use some of those slides that you wanted to show?
Oh, okay.
You?
Is it on the intermediate one? Okay, yeah. So I just want to show, I have four candidates here that I really wanted to talk about, but I want to highlight this one. These are radio pulsar wind nebula. So a lot of the studies of pulsar wind nebula are driven by radio observations. There is this growing class of radio nebula, which are huge, about 25 parsecs in size, huge for you know, SNR people, pulsar with nebula people. But so it's 25 parsecs inside. They have the brightness decreases as you go away from the center, which is indicative of some powering engine. But they have very steep spectral index, about 0.6, which is like the shell type remnant. So they have been proposed back in the 80s by Tom Landecker that these are actually pulsar with nebula, but there's something unusual about them. So we observe these with Chandra and XMM Newton, and the arrows point to the center where there's actually a radio depression in the intensity. And sure enough, we see Chandra X-ray sources surrounded by very compact nebula. So these sources are powered by, one of them is known to be the energetic pulsar. I mentioned we know that this is a pulsar with Q times 10 to the 37 Hz per second EDOT, so it's very powerful, almost as powerful as the Crab, not quite, but it's very far away, but it has a very small compact X-ray nebula. Okay, so the large size in radio suggests that it's a very highly evolved object, but the spin properties of this object seem to indicate that it's weak in X-ray emission. So it has this very compact nebula, and then the question, what makes, why are these objects so different? It's a very high EDOT, but the lowest LX over EDOT. And there's this object also that Roland has discovered in the radio, which has very similar properties. And Steve Reynolds and Gashik Borkowski had Chandra observation of it, and they also found a very weak X-ray source with barely resolvable pulsar wind nebula around them. So this is a growing interesting class of objects among the pulsar wind nebula population that deserves more attention. And we might be missing a lot of these objects because they're so compact in X-rays. One of the ideas is that they are high sigma winds. So the sigma is the ratio of the magnetic flux to pointing flux. So if you have a high sigma wind, you can end up having a more compact nebula or high magnetic field that makes them much more compact than they are in the radio. The other interesting thing about them is that they're highly polarized. This is a polarized intensity image, and they have a bipolar structure with a very highly ordered magnetic field in both cases. So I had a slide at the very end on studying magnetic fields in pulsar wind nebula with X-ray polarimetry.
We have a question by Steve.
Well, since you mentioned it, could you show the slides on magnetic fields in pulsar wind nebula?
Yeah, thank you. You guys this are really helping me.
This has to be quick, Samar.
Sorry?
This has to be quick.
Yeah, okay. I'll show it. It's actually, I don't have much to say other than showing it. Oh, sorry, this one. Here you go. So this is a snapshot of some magnetic field configuration in pulsar wind nebula, including some very famous ones. So it shows that the magnetic field can be highly ordered in some of them, like DA495, which is right here. This is the double-lobed structure, which is extremely highly polarized. This is Vela, except this is the compact nebula, and you have this big structure around it in the radio. Some of them are disordered in 3C58. There's evidence of possibly having both radial and toroidal magnetic field. This is another one I didn't get the chance to talk about, G63.7, another weird radio object with steep spectral index. So the point here is that X-ray polarimetry hopefully will help address some of these questions as well. Okay.
Okay, we'll have to hold any other questions to the break time. So let's thank Samar again.